And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Tonight's special guest, Lynn McTaggart, author of The Field, also an internationally recognized spokesperson on the science of spirituality. Ongoing results of an incredible mind over matter experiment. We're going to talk with Lynn about that as well, in addition to, of course, her work with The Field. Lynn, how are you?
I'm well. Great to be back, George.
Likewise. You know, we, again last night, conducted another consciousness effort to try to get it to rain over the forest-stricken areas here in L.A. These wildfires are going all over the place up there.
Yeah.
And today, there was no rain in the forecast at all. You know, other than smoke, the clouds, there were no clouds, other than smoke clouds. And today, it rained out there a little bit. Not a lot, but it rained out there a little bit. And now thunderstorms may be in that basin area. This stuff works, doesn't it?
It really does. I mean, as we'll be talking about this morning, we've been continually astonished by the power, and particularly the power of collective intention, which is what you're experimenting with. And the only difference we're doing is we're documenting it with a very rigidly scientifically controlled experiment. But whether it's in personal life or on the air, it works.
It does. Mine's not controlled. We're all over the place with this, to the point where they announced that they could get dried lightning, which is not good because we don't want that to zap any more dry land out there.
Well, that's the other thing that we've discovered too, George, is, you know, you have to be careful with this potent power because in the wrong hands or with the wrong phrasing or whatever, you know, you can get something a lot more than what you expected.
Well, now I know what they meant when they said, be careful what you wish for.
Absolutely.
All right. Tell me a little bit about this experiment, this intention experiment, how it came to be, what some of the method is behind it.
Really by accident, because I was interested in researching the power of intention. I'd heard a lot about intention, and I wanted to figure out what it was. I mean, it was a big buzzword everybody was using, and I also, it was leftover business from The Field. In some of the research there, which was looking at the work of frontier scientists around the world who were coming up with a completely new scientific story, what was coming across, aside from the fact that these remarkable discoveries about the zero-point field and the fact that we're all connected, what also was coming forward was the idea that consciousness is an actual physical something with the ability to change matter. And so being of a kind of a very fact-based person as I am, and always wanting to look at the scientific evidence, I wanted to find out, you know, how powerful this is. You know, what can we actually do with this? Can we do anything real in the world? And lots of people had also been talking about manifesting this, manifesting mm-hmm. stuff. You know, I'm going to use intention to get myself a new car or another job or whatever. And I also kept thinking to myself, you know, if this is so powerful, my goodness, can we use it to do anything to alleviate the catalog of suffering out there on the planet? So I kept looking for studies of group intention because that was what interested me most. You know, if thoughts were so powerful, what happens if you magnify this with lots of people thinking the same thing at the same time? Does that make the effect bigger?
Okay.
But the more I looked, the more I couldn't find very much, you know, in this area that had actually been scientifically proven. There was a lot of tantalizing evidence, but nothing really concrete. So my husband turned to me one night and said, well, why don't you do these experiments yourself? And that sounded pretty ridiculous to me because, you know, I haven't even studied science really I haven't been a scientist, and the last time I was, you know, I conducted an experiment was in high school, you know, in my high school biology class. But, you know, I've been writing about science for years, and I know many, many scientists, all these frontier scientists, and I also have readers around the world from The Field. And so I kept thinking, well, okay, if I put this all together and I use the internet as the interface between all of this, I'll have the biggest experiment in the world. And that's what we've been doing since 2007.
Perfect. Have you found yet whether one person, just an individual, can change the outcome of events? Just as good as someone who has.
We have a certain number of people.
Yeah.
We have one person who's maybe doing something different, and that can alter it.
Can they?
Well, I don't know. That's a really interesting question. One study we did that I ran in front of a group, I asked people to concentrate on one jar, and one of the people in the audience concentrated on another jar. And that was one of the few experiments that we got a null effect with. Now, I don't know if that had anything to do with it. There was also some other things in that the jars were put next to a lot of electromagnetic energy in the lab, and so that could have messed up the results too. So we won't know about that. But what I am finding is that there doesn't seem to be a real necessary critical mass that's needed. You know, sometimes small groups can be just as powerful, groups of 10 and 12 or 100, and as powerful as groups of 1,000 or 5,000 or 15,000, which is what happened with one of our experiments. But that what's more important is very focused thought, experience, being able to use different techniques, and I've developed a simple program after talking to a lot of intention masters, you know, the common threads of all the things that they do, I put together in a program, and that's been our protocol. And the more experienced somebody is in intending and highly focused thought, that seems to be the most important element.
How many different tests have you done, and how many will you do?
We've run 18 so far.
18.
And 16 of those have had positive results. I'm going to run them for as long as I can. And what I've been doing really is it's an ongoing investigation. So it means every time we do something, we learn from there, and then we move on to something else. So, you know, we started out really small. I mean, when I first thought about this, I thought about, you know, saving cancer patients and, you know, getting people out of burning buildings and, you know, and changing global warming and, you know, curing it. But when I first approached and the first scientist who very generously stepped forward was Dr. Gary Schwartz at the University of Arizona,
sure,
the noted psychologist. And he, you know, said, hey, I'll do the first ones with you. And I said, great, let's do, you know, cancer victims, burning buildings. And he said, hey, let's start with a leaf. And I went to myself, a leaf? You know, I mean, that's not exactly going to set the global consciousness on fire, you know, because I have the job of really drumming up interest. And I thought, how am I going to do this? But as he said, you know, listen, we've never done this before. We're going to have to start small and take baby steps. And that's really what we've been doing from the very first experiment we did, which was just trying to change the subtle light emissions that come out of a leaf. They're called biophoton emissions.
And how did you know that you did?
We photographed them and we counted them photon by photon. Dr. Schwartz has some very sophisticated equipment.
Yeah, he sure does.
And one of the things that he does is he photographs this living light. You know, we know all living things have this tiny current of light that they send out.
Yeah. We call it auras, don't we?
Yeah, we call it auras. And scientists call them biophoton emissions. And we know that a certain amount come out and they go and they increase or decrease depending on many factors. So we wanted to see if we could make increase them. And so I asked my audience in this first experiment to look at the leaf and make it glow. Imagine it glowing. And in this case, we actually had webcam images of leaves. And we had two leaves, too, because in all of our experiments, we've had multiple controls.
Yeah.
Because then that you have to do something to one of them and then compare that to the one you didn't do anything to see if you've got an effect. And that's how scientists do it. So after we were done, the scientists, also Dr. Schwartz and his team, didn't know which leaf we'd sent intention to. And he put both leaves in these highly sensitive cameras that can record very faint light in outer space. And he found that this equipment can also count the photons. And he found that there was a huge significant difference between the one we'd sent intention to and the one that compared to the one we hadn't. In fact, it was glowing. The one that we hadn't was darker than usual. It was almost like we'd stolen all of its light. So it was a really profound difference. And of course, we went back and replicated it a couple of times. I mean, that's the other important thing. If you do it once, all you've got is an interesting demonstration.
Yeah.
You've got to do it many times, and then you start interesting scientists, where you say, oh, okay, this is an effect. So in one case, we did our study six times. That was with we tried to make plants grow faster, and we tried that with six different studies, and in every single time, we had a significant effect.
So good thoughts create good deeds. Negative thoughts, I assume, go the other way.
That's the interesting thing. I mean, when I was researching my book, The Intention Experiment, I was operating under the assumption, as we all do, that positive thoughts are the most powerful thing. But when I actually looked at the evidence, negative thoughts can be just as powerful. Negative thoughts and thoughts used for evil and thoughts used by an experienced person for evil, let's say like a Qigong master sending out what they call destroying thoughts, destroying mind, that can be just as powerful as focused positive thoughts. So, yeah, it's true. Negative thoughts can be used for evil, and they are just as effective.
Lynn, we're going to take this quick break, then we're going to come right back with you and talk about these intention experiments, some of these big ones that you've done. We'll be back. And here we go. Lynn McTaggart, our special guest tonight. Lynn, let's talk about some of the intention experiments that you conducted. Let's start with the one about peace. How did you do this one?
Well, after all these baby steps, George, we decided to take a giant leap. I had been thinking about trying to do something about lowering violence for a long time after looking at the transcendental meditation studies. You know, there had been many carried out, and I'm sure you've talked about them,
mm-hmm.
where they found that if there's a critical mass of meditators in a certain area, the crime rate goes down.
Exactly.
So I kept thinking, well, wow, what if we actually target a place and send an intention there? Because in the TM studies, they weren't actually intending for anything. They were just meditating. And they thought that that kind of field they created, that field of positive energy, had something to do in lowering violence and crime of all sorts. So we started thinking about this, and I teamed up with a number of groups like the Unity people, because they had a season of peace and a week of peace the last year in September. And so I thought, well, okay, we'll try this little pilot thing, but I need a place that nobody is thinking about, because what's always important in a study is to try to do something to an area or to a person that isn't being done before. So that idea ruled out places like Iraq or Afghanistan.
Places where a lot of people are thinking about all the time.
Right, and praying for it all the time. So I didn't want people sending positive thoughts or prayer to this place, because that would muddy up our experiment.
Right.
So I needed a place nobody was thinking about. I also needed a lot of statistics. I assembled a big scientific team for this. Not only Dr. Schwartz, but I had Rustam Roy from Penn State University. I had Jessica Utz from California's University of California at Davis. She's probably one of the top statisticians. She's a professor of statistics, and she's one of the top statisticians in consciousness research. So, and she's very, she's highly, highly exacting. So if you can pass muster with her, you know your experiment's good. So, and I had Robert John and Brenda Dunn also advising. I had a whole team of people advising. They're from, the REG experiment, mm-hmm. the PEAR project at Princeton formerly. So I had a wonderful dream team telling me what I needed. And what they told me to do was to gather together 2 years plus of weekly violence statistics on the area. Some, needed weekly statistics on injuries and deaths and killings. So I needed a place where I can get that. And believe it or not, that's a really difficult thing to get. A lot of places that used to collect this data don't anymore. I even found out there's a Jack Bauer-like counter-terrorist unit in the American government. I discovered through the State Department. This was after about 4 or 5 weeks of looking. They have no phone number. They just have a website, and they gather this data. But when I finally, through all kinds of means, got hold of their phone number and got to them, they wanted to know everything about me, my Social Security number, my name, and why on earth I wanted weekly data on terrorist statistics and activity in any area. So I'm sure I'm on their list now.
Oh, yeah. They're all paranoid, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. So I couldn't convince them this is a scientific study. So just when I was about to give up, George, I found a guy who is basically the Gandhi of Sri Lanka, Kumar Rupasinghe. And he was collecting through his organization this kind of data, and it was highly reliable. So this was fantastic, and it was a match made in heaven because Sri Lanka was one of the most violent places on earth.
Yes.
It had a 25-year war. It had a very, very well-armed and well-trained rebel organization called the Tamil Tigers, who'd been fighting the government for 25 years. It had the most suicide bombers of anywhere else on earth. And, you know, as I say, at that time, the Tamil Tigers were in control of the north of Sri Lanka, and they were winning the war. So this seemed like a perfect target. It was a real place in need, and a place no one in America, that's for sure, was thinking about, and many other places either were thinking about it. So I didn't want to tell many people about this because this is just a pilot study. So I just told my own list. Nevertheless, it went viral on the net. Everybody was interested in this. The Dalai Lama had it on his site. Everybody started talking about it. And within weeks, I had thousands of people registered from 90 countries all over the world. So this was worrying me because I'd run a few experiments in the past, and I'd been a victim of my own success, and the website crashed when all those people tried to get on the website at the same moment. Because our experiments run by having people come to the web page all the same time, and it's only there that we reveal the target.
Right, and you need it working.
And we need it all working. So I got a special web team, and we went there, and we disclosed the target on the day. And it was really interesting to watch what happened because, contrary to any kind of expectations, during that week, and we ran the experiment every day for a half hour, so people had to come on, they had to get into this meditative state, go through the whole thing, and we controlled the pages. So they went through a step-by-step process with us. All these thousands of people, I think we had about 15,000, 20,000 people doing it from all these countries around the world every day. And what happened was we expected violence immediately to go down over these 8 days. Violence quadrupled during that week.
Quadrupled, okay.
Quadrupled, and I was terrified. Yes. I thought, oh, my goodness.
Well, you were doing what we've done sometimes. It was going the wrong way.
Well, this is really worrying, George, but then was really interesting. That very week, the government gained control. They started doing a couple of initiatives, and that was why there was so much violence, that completely turned the war around. Violence began to plummet then, and over the coming weeks, it decreased by 75%. Now, later on, in later months, it did go up again, but here's what happened. Then, by January, the government took control of the north. They managed to get hold of the pass where the Tamil Tigers had controlled it.
Mm-hmm.
And by the springtime, the war was over. Now, I was wondering about all of this because, again, I try to approach it really scientifically.
Sure.
I had my team look at it from every angle. And first of all, we looked at the weekly statistics, and we found that there was no doubt that our week was somehow pivotal in the violence, in the stats of everything that had happened for those 2.25 years. Jessica Utz did a time analysis looking at all of this material over all of these years and looking at what had happened in the past and what should have happened in the future as a result of it. And once again, she found our week was pivotal. Our week was probably the most violent week of the war. And nevertheless, after that, the whole course of the war changed. And finally, we had Roger Nelson of the Global Consciousness Project, who has these REG machines all over the world running continuously, monitoring what happened.
Did he get some spikes there?
We had remarkable spikes, George, and we had them right in the 10 minutes each day that we were meditating, sending the intention. It was that specific. And so all of these scientists said, wow, there's something going on here, that obviously there was something pivotal in that week. So once again, this was one experiment. We're going to run it again. We're going to run it somewhere else this year, and we're going to continue doing peace intention experiments. But it sure looks like something went on there.
Can you try for a more targeted area that is out in the news, or would that damper the test?
No, we could try. I mean, I was worried about a place like Iraq because, as I say, everybody's praying for it. Everybody's been worried about it. Or Afghanistan, everybody's praying for it. We could take a place, a very violent place in America, for instance. You know, we could take one of the most violent cities in America where we're concerned about
Detroit, St. Louis. They're high per capita.
Exactly. And so we may do something like that. Once again, I wouldn't want to reveal some of the ideas that we're working on at the moment because it has to be a surprise on the day or people start thinking about that ahead of time. So that's why we don't reveal it to people until the very minute of the experiment when it starts. And then people, you know, we give them the information. So that we do that with every experiment. So it's a surprise on the day.
All right. You did one on clean water. Tell me about that.
Okay, well, this is interesting, and this is an ongoing experiment. In fact, we're running our next one on September 19th.
All right.
So for anyone who wants to be involved, I can talk about how they can do that. We decided to start looking at real things. You know, we've done a lot of experiments on leaves. We've done a lot of experiments on trying to make plants grow faster. Now we wanted to start looking at whether we could tackle some real problems in the world. So one of the biggest problems is clean water. So I have a series of experiments planned and a few that we've already done looking at different aspects of cleaning up polluted water. So the first one that we ran in June with Dr. Schwartz again was looking at whether or not we could change the energetic footprint of tap water to be much more like the energetic footprint of mineral water.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that, and we asked people we'd actually show them the photos of what it looks like, and you could see a real difference with this special equipment. What tap water looks like when it sends out its, you know, its energetic footprint.
Well,
we've
seen what Dr. Emoto has done.
Well, it's kind of similar,
yeah.
Except all we're doing is we're quantifying it with really rigorous scientific evidence. In fact, Masaru Emoto and I are going to be running an experiment together in Japan on a real lake next March.
Good. Okay.
Once again, we're taking baby steps here because we're, you know, asking to clean up polluted water is a big ask because, you know, there's a lot of things in water that make it polluted. There's chemicals, there's, you know, there's different pH, there's all kinds of things. So we want to try to tackle it one stage at a time. So this is the first one, just saying, okay, can we make tap water more like mineral water in its essence, its energy? And the answer is, at least according to the first experiment, yes. Now, once again, one experiment is only one thing. We've got to replicate it a number of times. We tried to replicate it then in front of a group. That was with people from, I think we had 70 countries involved in that experiment in June. And we had positive results. I ran it again in a workshop of about 200, and we didn't get any results. So we're running it again in September. So that confirms, just to confirm that, you know, what we've got is real. But now, then after that, we're planning an experiment with Melinda Connor, also of University of Arizona, to try to change pH of water.
Now, that's going to be remarkable if you can pull that off.
Well, there's been some interesting evidence, George, on this. William Tiller did this, the physicist William Tiller. But Melinda's been working on some really interesting experiments showing that you can change the pH of water to something very similar to wine. So all you have to do is add a little food coloring, and you've literally changed water into wine.
Didn't that happen about 2,000 years ago?
Well, now we're doing it in the lab, George. And then after that, then we're going to be tackling with a scientist called Beverly Rubick. She's an expert on bacteria. We're going to try to mutate bacteria in water from bad bacteria, harmful bacteria, to good bacteria, benign bacteria, because, you know, lots of bacteria is really helpful to things like digestion.
Absolutely. So it's got to be the right kind.
Right, exactly. Now, bacteria mutate easily, and there's been some evidence that using salts to mutate bacteria can work. So we're going to try that next, too. So then adding all of those up, we should have a series of really positive studies showing that we can use collective thoughts to do something like clean up water and clean up pollution.
How many people does it take to do an effective experiment? Can't you do it with one very tuned in person, or do you need 10, 50, 1,000?
Okay, well, our experiments show that there isn't really a critical mass that's necessary. I mean, I run experiments in my workshops of 10 people working in little groups of 10, and we've had some remarkable results I'll tell you about shortly. But what I found is, as I said, I don't think it's numbers. I think it's experience.
True.
We ran one experiment. We ran a series of experiments seeing if we could make seeds grow faster. And it was fascinating because in every single case, and in this experiment, we had not just one control. We had three controls. So we had one set of targeted seeds, and the rest were just seeds, you know, that weren't targeted. We planted all of them. In every case, the seed scent intention grew higher, but in one instance, they grew twice as high. We had this remarkable result, and it was when I was running the experiment in front of a group of 600 highly experienced healing touch practitioners. So these were people who were really experienced in sending intention. They had a particular protocol. They had, you know, they had practiced getting into a certain mind state, a certain emotional state. And so they were real master intenders.
Have you found that time and space doesn't affect this at all?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, this is the thing that's remarkable about it. Remember, when we're doing our experiments, we get everybody coming on our website and sending an intention to the picture we have on the website. Now, let's say for the clean water experiment, we had a picture of a petri dish of water. And they're sending it to that, but they're not sending it to the actual dish itself sitting in front of them. They're just sending it to a photograph, the representation of that dish sitting there in University of Arizona. Now, when we ran the germination experiment, which is the seeds experiment, I ran that not only on the internet, but every time I was speaking in front of a group, large or small. Now, the first time I ran it was in Sydney, Australia. So I had a group of about 600 people there in Sydney, and the seeds were sitting there back in University of Arizona in Tucson, Arizona. So they were thousands and thousands of miles away. So space certainly didn't make a difference. Now, for time, we've not run a retro intention, but there have been many retro intentions that's what they call them, when you send an intention back in time to affect something. I'd like to do that sometime. Certainly, there are many studies showing that you can do this and do it effectively.
What is the force, Lynn, that somehow carries this intent to a specific region or area? Like you said, you don't have to concentrate exactly where it is. Some people do it on a photograph. But there's got to be a force out there that carries this, that somehow collects it and then delivers it.
Okay. Well, first of all, we have to get past the paradigm that we think of when we think of what we are and what the rest of the world is. You know, science has told us, and science tells us the stories we live by. And the story we've been told, according to science, and really it's Newtonian science, is that we're all a bunch of very well-behaved and separate objects, all jostling around in empty space. And that's what we think of ourselves. We think of the world as a collection of finite and discrete objects that end with themselves. So we think that we end with the hairs on our skin, and that's where the rest of the world begins. And so when we think of sending intention, we think of something weird being transmitted from us to them. But actually, what scientists are understanding is that, you know, there's no out there. We're all part of one giant energy field.
Let's pick that up, Lynn, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, Lynn, we were talking before the top of the hour of this force that somehow pushes and gets this stuff done. Go ahead. Let's pick it up from there.
Well, most of us have been brought up with this whole idea that we're separate and that we're, you know, separate objects out there in space, and that I am a kind of finalized assemblage and a discrete and final thing that can't affect any of those other separate things out there. But current scientific theory, and this is what's being discovered by these wonderful frontier scientists all over the world, has now understood us all to be part of this giant energy field called the zero-point field. And that when you get right down to it, when you look at our subatomic particles, for instance, you know, we've always thought of them as like little billiard balls, you know, that electrons are like little billiard balls going around a very organized little nucleus. And nothing could be further from the truth. Subatomic particles are some weird, they're like weird vibratory bits of nothingness, lots of energy buzzing back and forth. And that's actually what we're made of. We're kind of energy, you know, we're a packet of vibrating energy, subatomic particles, doing a little dance with the zero-point field.
And we're 14 billion years old, too, aren't we?
Yes. And we're just, that energy isn't dying, it's just being transmuted. And we're sending energy back and forth with this, you know, we're trading energy with the zero-point field. All subatomic particles trade energy all the time, like an endless game of tennis. So what we understand is that we are part of this quantum energy field, and that has two big implications for intention. First of all, it means that we're all fundamentally on a subatomic level connected via this field. And secondly, it means that we can access the furthest reaches of the cosmos. Now, we're also beginning to understand that thought is another kind of energy. You know, that it is just another form of energy and part of this field as well. So the way that we can affect things remotely is just the simple idea that we're extending via this field to the furthest reaches of the cosmos. So we can be in touch with any part of the world at any moment,
now,
part of the universe.
Lynn, I'm basing this question based on my own experience, but why does it seem that when you push for something, I mean push for it, it doesn't seem to happen? But when you lay back, you think about it, maybe you dream on it, it just seems to flow. Things seem to work out better.
Well, remember, I interviewed a lot of intention masters and asked them about this. You know, when I was trying to put together my program and to figure out how can I distill all the teachings of all of these people into a simple program people can use, I asked them all for their main steps, and all of them, intention masters, and that was master healers, Qigong masters, Buddhist monks, all people using intention to really remarkable effect, all said what's really important is to, first of all, stop efforting, you know, to use a great American term, you know, trust the process. Let go.
Mm-hmm.
You put out your intention. It's like you put out your empty cup, and then you just trust the process that it's going to be filled. So they always say to detach from the outcome. You know, be very specific, put out your request, and then out of the way. Just realize this isn't you doing this. You're all part of, you're part of this field. You're part of this process.
And let it go.
And let it go.
Is there any downside to any of this? Did you find in your experiments that there are things that could go wrong? And what would cause that to go wrong, if that's possible?
Well, as I mentioned, with our peace intention experiment, violence quadrupled during that week.
Yeah.
So that was pretty scary.
Yeah, but it worked out eventually, right?
It worked out eventually. We always wondered whether or not that was going to be part of the process and that things had to get worse before they got better, or whether it had to do with the fact that one of the pages that I'd used for the experiment had, I wanted to show people and get people compassionately involved with Sri Lanka. Most people, particularly people in America, you know, I've barely heard of Sri Lanka, let alone known what's gone on there for all these years. So I needed to let people know a little bit about the Tamil Tigers. So I included some photos of warfare in there, the warfare there. And they weren't horrendous photos, but they were, you know, they were graphic. They were showing violence. So I always wondered whether or not that was one of the aspects. Now, when we got to the intention page, I had a picture of children of Sri Lankan children of different ethnic groups hugging each other, and beautiful pictures of waterfall, and all positive images. But the images of the page before were quite negative. So was that a factor? We won't know until we run a few of them to find out. So I think, you know, I think in life, here's a real typical example. When people want to do something like get out of debt, what they're thinking about all the time is debt, 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 as they showed in The Secret. You know, that is what you end up manifesting. And so if you're doing an intention experiment and you want to, and you're thinking about, let's say we're doing something on polluted water, and we keep focusing on the fact that it's polluted, we'll probably make it more polluted. So I think there's something really to the whole idea of focusing on the positive, focusing on the outcome. And so most of the intention experiments we suggest, and the more casual ones we do weekly ones, intentions of the week and financial intentions of the week for individuals. We put them on our website. We ask everybody to send intention to them. And we always focus on making a positive statement.
Have you found that the target of the intent has to be something that's within grasp? Here's an example. What happens if a million people all get together one day for the summoning up of a UFO? For example, they wanted to land on the White House lawn. You know, that's a long shot. It's a long shot. You know, it's more difficult to do that than for a million people to think about, let's create a sunspot on the sun, for example. But can things like that still happen, as far-fetched as it might seem?
Well, you know, George, that's making me laugh, because I had a friend who was so tired of hearing people like Edgar Mitchell and many of the others who are credible people,
yeah,
scientists, saying there are UFOs. He was so tired of them being put down, he thought we ought to do an intention experiment for just that. I'm sure it's possible.
What if it worked?
What if it worked? I know. I'm sure it's possible. I certainly have seen a lot of evidence that there is, you know, there are UFOs. I think the question is really, is that the way for us to manifest them, you know, just so they can come on the, you know, will they want to listen to us, is I guess what I'm really asking. So, you know, I think, you know, if you're asking, can we manifest the extraordinary? Well, I've seen it right in front of me. I've seen workshops where I've been running workshops on intention and living with intention. And we've been using intention to heal because, you know, if I'm running a weekend workshop, I can't show people the power of intention by saying, okay, over this weekend you're going to get a new job or you're going to get a new car. So I thought, well, let's try something like tackling some of the healing challenges in the group. And we've had people with things like, you know, who are practically blind. They had opacities. I had a woman who had an opacity in one eye. And a small group, we divided everybody into small groups and asked them to send intention to the people with the challenges. Mm-hmm. She was one of them. And on Sunday, she reported that her sight was 80% better.
My gosh.
So, you know, and this happens over and over and over again. So I'm no guru or healer. But what I think is going on is this extraordinary power of the group, power of community.
When intent is initiated, is it done via the brain or is it the subconscious outside of the brain?
Well, okay, I guess we have to answer that. We have to define what the brain is. And in my view, you know, the view of most neuroscientists, the brain is the repository of consciousness. You know, everything you have, you know, all your consciousness is locked up inside your skull. Well, the evidence that I've seen and been studying about all sorts of things, from near-death experiences to intention, convinced me that the brain is much more like a transducer and that consciousness is within and without us. You know, mm-hmm. It's not locked up inside our brain.
It's like radio waves. They're out there.
Yeah, we're a television set and a television station all rolled up in the same thing. And I don't think it's your brain that's doing it. I think it's your being, your consciousness that's sending the intention. And in a sense, you're hooking up to the field again. I look at it that way. The other thing that I think is real important to understand is people always think of intention as the big single power thought. You know, I get my power thought in the morning while I'm meditating, mm-hmm. I send out that intention. And they figure that all the rest of the day, what I think about doesn't matter because that one power thought's been the important one. But from the scientific evidence, we know we're sending out that little current of light all the time, those biophoton emissions. And what's also really interesting is the science shows us that living things are sending back information back to us via those light emissions. So we're sending and receiving almost like, you know, an information source on cue. We're sending information synchronicitously. This has been proven in studies. So that's a form of communication that's going on all the time, whether we know it or not. You know, we run a lot of experiments embedding intention in water and asking people who are part of our groups to try to discern what's the intention embedded in the water. And an extraordinarily high percentage of people can pick out what's been embedded in the water. So that tells us that information can be sent out and picked up by us. We're receiving and sending on a different level all the time.
How do we use this in our everyday life to benefit our lifestyle, to benefit our own existence?
First of all, I think what's really important is to become conscious of what it is you're sending all the time. Because if you've got an intention for something, but you're sabotaging yourself all the time, I think you need to become aware of that. And it's not only becoming aware of what you're thinking all the time. I mean, that's an important enough thing. It's just starting to monitor your thoughts. You know, just monitor what you're thinking. So if you're sending out an intention, you know, I want to get a good new job, and I want to do this and such. I want to become a lawyer, let's say, and I want to go to law school. But all the rest of the time, you're sending intentions. Your thoughts are sabotaging that because you're saying, I'll never get in. I can't do it. Look how you muffed that one. All that sort of stuff that goes through our heads most of the time, that's our inner monologue that's more or less monitoring and critiquing our lives. If that's happening to you all the time, that's going to sabotage anything you send intention to. So the first thing you have to do is get in touch with that. And one of the easiest ways is just to write down what you're thinking for a couple of days, and you'll start seeing the pattern.
Sometimes, Lynn, this doesn't come. It doesn't happen. It doesn't work. Why?
Why intention doesn't work?
Mm-hmm.
Well, for a number of reasons. One is you could be subconsciously sabotaging it, and I think that's when many of the energy psychology techniques really help. Anything from emotional freedom to thought field therapy, to Psych-K, those kinds of energy psychologies are little techniques that you can work with a therapist or work by yourself that get you in touch with a lot of the thinking that has been, in a sense, programmed into you that sabotages some of your highest good. The other thing, too, is for us to understand, remember, it's not you who's actually putting this into effect. So you have to be, one of the things about letting go of the process is being open to the way the universe works and how it works.
But you need to understand that.
You need to understand that or just trust the process. I give you a short example.
All right.
My daughter, who's now at university over here in England, where I live, she was desperate to go to one university. I'll call it Wessex, and it was a top university. If you don't go to Oxford, you go there. So she applies. She doesn't get in. She applied to a number of other ones, and she got in. She was going to study English. Now, she had thought about studying psychology. It was kind of her first choice, but she thought she needed sciences, more sciences than she had. So she applied for English. Now, in England, you get a contingent. You get a conditional place at universities. You still have to pass tests at the end of the summer. You get your results. And you usually it'll say, well, you're in if you get two A's and a B. So she got her test results, and both of the universities she'd been accepted to said, yes, but you got to get, you know, you got to have a lot of A's, and one of your A's has got to be in English. She just missed her A in English, so both the universities rejected her. So what happens over here in England is then you are thrown into a thing called clearing, where you have to look through what's left at all the universities. Now, my kid's pretty smart, and so I was dying for her because I thought, oh, my goodness, she's going to get all she's going to get the dreck. We go through this list. We don't find anything good in English. So I start saying, okay, well, let's just look. Let's just, for the heck of it, let's go see what Wessex has got left. And there was psychology, two places left. She calls up, and you have to call for hours to get through the phone. Everybody's calling to try to get these last places. She managed to get through. She had the interview. She had the grades. She got in. She ended up with her first choice of study and her first choice of university.
How about that?
So that was saying, let it go. Sometimes the universe delivers to you in the way that you didn't expect. But I can tell you, there was only one intention she had, which was to go to that university.
Sometimes, Lynn, when people try this, it doesn't work right away. And we've talked a little bit about why. But should they give up? Or should they realize that not everything happens, sometimes it takes a little longer than they want, and to just stay focused and positive?
Absolutely. I mean, never give up. Never give up. Just trust the universe to provide you with what you want and what you need. And sometimes that'll mean coming through the back door. Sometimes it'll be doing via a different route. But I think what you have to do is just have that faith that something will happen. Now, I know that's a process that has to be developed, too. But it's about having that inner faith, trusting the process, and continually focusing every so often on what it is you want, and then let it go and go about your business. But just trusting that something's going to happen that will give you what you want and need, just not necessarily via the route you think is best for you.
Can masses think negatively to hurt us, to affect us?
Oh, absolutely. I think there is such a thing as a collective, almost like a virus that takes hold. I think that's what we saw in Nazi Germany. I think that's what we've seen in many instances. I think that can be a case, you know, politically, we shift one way or another. And that becomes a collective movement that takes hold. I think we felt collectively defeated after 9/11, and that took hold for a while. I think the financial crisis has given us this whole kind of sense of mass panic.
Yeah, another rabbit punch, Lynn. We'll be back with you in just a moment. We'll also talk more about your work, The Field. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Lynn McTaggart, our guest, calls with Lynn next hour. Lynn, when you wrote the book, The Field, what got you into that area?
It was just by accident, George. I run a newsletter called What Doctors Don't Tell You, and I look at what works and what doesn't work in medicine. So I study the medical literature a lot, and I decode that for people. So in the course of doing that, I kept coming across really good studies of things like spiritual healing, acupuncture, and homeopathy. And I sat back one day and I said to myself, you know, if this is true, if this stuff really works, and there's plenty of evidence showing that it does, then this completely upends everything we believe about how we work and how the universe works. And so it was just curiosity as a journalist that got me into it. I kept thinking to myself, well, there must be something like human energy fields that could explain this. So if I go talk to a couple of frontier scientists, they're going to know all about this. I'll write it up and, you know, hand it in, basically. You know, little did I know that this is going to take, you know, years and 75 scientists later and, you know, years and years and years of digging and reading through, you know, hundreds of scientific studies to try to piece this together. And also that nobody else had actually pieced it together. Scientists are very good at doing their own little patch of stuff, but they hate to venture beyond what they've discovered to make any kinds of statements about, you know, how it all works, how it all fits together.
Isn't the zero-point field, which is what your book is based on, the same as the experiments you've been conducting with intent?
All connected. I think it's the medium through which it all works. Yes. I think it's, once again, I think it's really important for us to get past the idea that we're all discrete things that can only affect each other by some sort of physical process like force. You know, this is what really Newton showed. You know, if you want to influence something, you've got to freeze it, drop it, burn it, kick, or give it a good swift kick. You know, you have to do something physical to something else. That's what we've always believed. But if you look at these new scientific evidence, you understand that, you know, life is much more like a process rather than a fixed something. You know, we're a constant, we are having an exchange of energy. We're having a little relationship with the field all the time, just sending stuff back and forth. So in a sense, you and I are a different something every minute of our lives because we're always changing and transferring energy. We're like this complete protean entity, constantly changing. So if that's the case, and we're just changing energy back and forth, it's not too far-fetched to think that our energy transfer to something else can also happen through thought.
Let's talk a little bit about the science, Lynn, behind this. Though you have talked about it, and just a few others, there's not a lot of basis of science behind it because they're not jumping forward with major tests. How do we get science, major physicists, for example, to start checking into this?
There are a lot of scientists. I mean, that was the purpose of writing the intention experiment as well as the field. I wanted to show people how much science there is about this. It's not being broadcast on the top of Nature or the top of Newsweek, but it's there. It's just, you know, frontier scientists, they work in a real vacuum. You know, they're doing a lot of work on things that's years before, you know, the mainstream accept it and agree with it. But it's all there, and it's published in their kind of arcane journals.
Aren't they the rogue scientists, though? The good ones, but they're the rogue scientists?
Not all of them. Some of them sort of walk the fine line between rogue and non-rogue. Hal Puthoff, who has been one of the big champions of the zero-point field, I mean, he's been doing a lot of work for, you know, with Lockheed and NASA, looking into trying to extract energy from the zero-point field for space travel. Because, if you know, they've demonstrated there is energy out there, and it's really dense. And, you know, if you and I were sitting across from each other and we were about a yard away, the energy between us would be enough to boil all the oceans in the world. So that's how much energy there is out there. It's very, very dense. So if you can extract it from thin air, you'll have a way to power rockets to distant galaxies. And so that's what they're thinking of, because you know, if we did it currently with fossil fuel, you'd need a rocket as big as the sun to get there. So they're really interested in doing that. And that used to be little black projects, you know, projects that weren't, were hushed up. Now they're not. Now they're out there in the open. So there's been a acknowledgement that the zero-point field exists. But in terms of consciousness research, you're right. They are, some of them are rogue scientists, but they're rogue scientists with impeccable credentials.
Yes.
So, you know, this year's revolutionary is tomorrow's George Washington. You know, these guys will be considered mainstream when we look backward.
Let's talk a little bit more about Gary Schwartz, University of Arizona professor, and some of his research on healers and Reiki practitioners in areas like that. He's a home run. He's one of the best.
Gary is fantastic, and we've really enjoyed working together because we're like two little kids trying to figure out what our next intention experiment is going to be. And by the way, I work with different scientists, not just one, although Gary's done the most with me, because I think it's really important to show that any lab we can get results in, not just one lab. But Gary's done his own fantastic work. He's done a lot of energy experiments. And some of the things that I thought were really interested was finding why experiments with healers sometimes worked and sometimes didn't. Sometimes, by that I mean, sometimes they were on their mark and they could heal things, and sometimes they couldn't. So he wondered about this, and he started looking into the healers themselves and started giving them some tests. And he found that when they were healthy and well in every way, they were more likely to hit their target. So another reason why experiments and why intentions don't work in your own life can be that you're not on top of your game when you're sending them. Now, sometimes you can't be on top of your game. Sometimes you're sending an intention to heal, so you're actually not feeling too well. But he did find that, as I say, when healers were at least emotionally and mentally well, then they were more likely to be effective. So that was pretty fascinating, I think. That was some of Gary's most interesting work. He's also found that what's very interesting about intention, sending intention to someone, it's really important to have that person that you're sending to believe it's going to work. And it seems to me that some of his work suggests that there's an alchemy that goes on between the sender and the receiver, that it's the joint belief that seems to create the difference.
Tell me a little bit about the ancients who practiced this. They had the uncanny ability. I don't mean Jesus, but there were others who practiced this on a day-to-day basis. How did they know this?
I think there's a lot of information. I mean, I'm looking into this. I'm doing a lot of research now looking at this and different ways of living.
That's another book for you.
And replacing what we've come up with now and living much closer to what the new science tells us. And to understand that, I've had to look to different paradigms. Now, what's really interesting on how we formulate how we live is that we train our brains to see certain things. And that's all we can see, you know, and so we think that life is finite and that we live in this very well-behaved Newtonian universe, and that's all we're able to see. It's just like when you deal with positive, you know, when pessimists and an optimist, a pessimist has got to the point where he can't see the good anymore. He literally can't see it physically anymore because his brain's so used to making the connections that everything goes bad in his life. Now, with these other cultures, they relied on different senses and a different perception. They saw the world differently, and so they picked up information that we don't necessarily pick up. They also started with a worldview that everything was all connected. Almost every culture but our current Western one has understood that there is a zero-point field-like animatory principle behind everything. They've always thought of everything as, you know, used different language for it, but it really boils down to understanding life as this kind of unity with a central unifying force. So they also picked up information. They were used to and trained themselves to pick up a lot more information intuitively and to understand that things like thoughts and positive, being positive, affected life. So it's like, you know, it's like when you look at the tsunami of a few years ago.
Yeah.
There were, first of all, no animals other than animals that were tied down got killed. They all intuitively understood there was something going on, and they ran to high ground. So did three native cultures. They watched the whole thing from the very high ground. They were all safe. Three little native cultures that were there. So they also had learned and trained themselves to pick up stuff much more intuitively. So it wasn't just that they were, you know, picking up a change in the wind. They'd actually intuited that this was all going to happen. So that's just learning to operate according to a different mindset. What's interesting to me, though, in interviewing a lot of these different masters of intention who came from different cultures, is that they had certain peculiarities with their own techniques, but mostly they shared a lot of similarities. Almost all of them used a highly focused mind state, highly focused. It was like they were attending with every pore of their body, and they energized themselves.
Through meditation?
Well, they started with meditation, but they moved into something further than that, George. What's interesting is when they've done studies on Buddhist monks involved in high states of intention, their brains aren't slowing down as they usually do in meditation. They start speeding up. So they move to the point where the brain is operating far faster than it does in ordinary waking consciousness. They go into gamma cycles, which is a brain working at absolute peak attention. It's something much faster than our usual speed in our day-to-day lives. So from that, I've seen in all of these different cultures that they use meditation and focused brain states and all their five senses to have this extreme focus, and from there they send out the intention. So one of the things they do is send out a very, very focused body and mind state. They also get into a very highly charged emotional state, so that when you said, where is it coming out of? Intention's basically coming out of the heart.
Do you ever see the day where they will be able to concentrate this power and put it into some kind of device or piece of equipment, and we can use it like, oh, I don't know, almost like the mind reader machine or something?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, William Tiller has done this. I mean, this is the thing that's amazing. He's done a lot of studies. I've called them his black box studies, because he's been able to get a bunch of meditators around, have them all think of a certain intention while he's been turning on this little black box. It's just like the size of a remote control. It's a simple electronic device. And he's attempted to embed this device with this intention. He'd then wrap up this device and send it 1,000 miles away to another lab. Now, the intention would be very specific, to do some sort of scientific process. In one case, he had an intention, had the meditator send an intention to speed up the development of fruit flies from larva to the fly.
Hmm.
And make that faster. And he's run this over, you know, many, many hundreds of trials, and it worked. And he's done it with all kinds of, he's done four or five different kinds of studies with this.
To the point where he could conclude, this really does work.
Oh, yeah, that he's embedding intention into this. He can send this elsewhere, this device elsewhere, turn it on, and it works. It's as though those people were in the room sending the intention themselves. So once again, if we can do that, you know, if thought's just another kind of energy, and we can imprint this device with this information, if it's information we're sending, then there's no reason why we can't embed it in a machine, or even embed it in water. I mean, that's some of the experiments we do. As I said earlier, we send an intention or even a simple word into a jar of water, and then ask people in the audience to figure out what the word is in the water, and an overwhelming number know it, pick it up. So if that's something we can embed in water, and water is a very weird process, a weird substance, it acts in a sense like a tape recorder. It can pick up information and encode it. So there's no reason why we can't develop a device to do this.
Will it allow us to maybe communicate with the other side?
Why not? I mean, this is, you know, another possibility. I mean, I think once you start realizing we're very different from what we've been told, we're an energy system. We're not actually a self, but something that's connected. There's no reason to not think that thoughts are maybe the way we should communicate with both the other side and extraterrestrial beings. I mean, but the other side, I mean, a lot of studies have demonstrated. Gary Schwartz has done some wonderful afterlife experiments, and certainly there's been a lot of information with near-death experiences, a lot of studies of that demonstrating that consciousness doesn't seem to die.
What about animals? Do they have this ability? Intention from animals? What kind of perception?
We learn from animals. I've been studying animals and animal things that they, what animals do to learn from them. How they pick up information. So, you know, animals in a sense live in the field. They live the field. And we could learn a lot from them because they pick up information hugely intuitively. I'll give you a wonderful story of this. My dog, which is he's a little Cavalier King Charles Spaniel, is very, you know, he's a very willful little character. And when he was a baby, you know, we had trained him, and we walk in this big common near us, and he walks off the leash. But one day he got lost, and he actually made his own way home. So we have a neighbor who's kind of the mayor of the neighborhood. And she was
appointed, right?
Sorry, yeah, self-appointed. And she was, I met up with her once when I had Ollie with me, and she was telling her neighbor, her other neighbor, that Ollie was pretty useless because he, you know, we'd gone through all this training, but he'd still run away. And at the moment she said this, while I was smiling, my dog went up to her and peed all over her Wellington boot, and then turned around and did the same on the other side. So now I didn't say anything, betray anything, but I think he intuited the whole thing. So he either, you know, picked up my discomfiture, either he was reading my thoughts or he understood what she was saying.
Well,
so either way, it's weird.
We know animals sense the other side. You know, a lot of us have witnessed, you know, dogs or cats just kind of looking in very strange corners, ceilings, and, you know, they know there's something there.
There's definitely something there. And also, I mean, I think animals are, you know, what Temple Grandin, the animal trainer, calls splitters. They pick up information in tiny pieces and in exquisite detail. We're lumpers. We see, you know, if we see a face, we just say, oh, right, that's George. We stop looking at the ear and the nose and the eye. So it's like we don't pick up detail. And that happens in every aspect of our lives. So animals are exquisitely in tune and attuned to tiny, tiny detail. And so that's part of how they become so intuitive, I think.
Let's take some phone calls when we come back. Lynn's websites, she's got a couple of them, theintentionexperiment.com, lynnmctaggart.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We'll be back in a second with your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Lynn, every Friday we conduct consciousness prayer for people who need help. I get emails and they get on a list, and some remarkable things have happened, there's no doubt. But, you know, some of the emails I get are just, you know, heartbreaking. I just got one about 20 minutes ago from someone who said his sister has inoperable pancreatic cancer. And would we put her on the list? Of course we will. But it doesn't work all the time, does it?
Well, I mean, it depends on what you mean by work. Sometimes it is that person's time to go. And as I say, the force that's doing this is not necessarily you or me or all of us. And so we also have to understand that perhaps that person's highest good is to release and to go on to the other side. You know, we can't know. But many cases it does work. We run an intention of the week and also a financial intention of the week on our intention experiment website. And we've found some really remarkable stories, as well as remarkable stories when we've just done it in small groups. So I think there's a very special power that happens both with the group and with the recipient, knowing that a group of strangers is out there sending him intention. I think there's something special about that. We've so lost the power of community. And I think that to know, to connect back with that is something really magical and transforming.
And it does. I've seen it work.
I've seen it in a group too, and I was so fascinated by it. I actually wanted to study why this is, and I was really interested to see, for instance, the Japanese who smoke like chimneys have a really low incidence of heart disease. And one epidemiologist wanted to find out about this, so he looked at studies of Japanese coming to America, and he found that their heart attack rate then mimics the American heart attack rate. So when he looked into it further, he found it wasn't diet. It wasn't because they were eating too many Big Macs. It was because they'd lost their traditional kinds of communities. And he was so fascinated by this, he went to Japan to find the X factor in their communities that makes it so special. And they said, well, you Americans, you're so lonely. You walk down the street alone. Anybody could see that. And I thought that was a really powerful statement for why our little intention communities can work so powerfully. You know, there's a connection with community that we've lost that happens in this.
Is this power of intent strong enough to protect ourselves from all the negative bombardments that are out there from all kinds of factions and people?
You know, a lot of people say, oh, should you put up a psychic bubble? How do you protect yourself from negativity? And this interested me a lot, and I looked into this in the intention experiment, the book. And I wondered, you know, do psychic barriers work? Is that what we should be doing? And first of all, the studies showed they don't work that well, or sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. But more importantly, I started thinking about this whole thing of being all connected. You know, if we're seriously all connected, if we're all just trading information back and forth, and we're all just shape-shifting, well, is it really a good idea to then protect yourself against everything else? Shouldn't we be open to everything else? So I started thinking, well, what's the best protective device? And in looking at it, I was really impressed by the work of Dr. John Diamond. He wrote the book Your Body Doesn't Lie, and he's been probably the pioneer in using behavioral kinesiology, what he calls behavioral kinesiology. That's using muscle testing to test toxic thoughts. And he's found that there's one really powerful antidote to any negativity, and that is, you know, and he's tested people, thousands of people, with all kinds of toxic thoughts, like, you know, he'll say to them things like, your mother doesn't love you, or tire's flat, and your hand, your arm goes, you know, weak, your deltoid arm muscle goes weak then when he does that. But the one thing that keeps it really strong is when somebody gets in touch with what it is that puts them in touch with the divine. What activity is like their life's work? What's the thing that they most love doing more than anything else? Now, it doesn't have to be your job. It doesn't even have to be doing anything big and important like being president of the United States. It can be just making a perfect chocolate cake. You know, anything like that that puts you absolutely, you know, makes you transcendent.
And makes you feel good.
Makes you feel really good. That is the strongest thing. So I think he calls it your homing thought. And I think connecting with that being if that's your life purpose, just thinking of your life's purpose, getting back in touch with your feelings about that activity is a really powerful antidote to negativity. And I think that's what you should be in touch with when you are surrounded in that situation.
All right, to the phones we go now. Let's go to Chicago, Illinois. First time caller, Jeff. You're up with us. Hey, Jeff, go ahead.
Hey, it's a pleasure to talk to you, George. I've been listening to your show for about 10 years now.
Well, thank you, Jeff. Thanks for calling.
A question for your guest is that if I send an intent to a loved one, could that person be healed even though that person may be unaware that I'm sending intent or maybe not even believing that this works?
Yes, it can happen. It can work. There have been many studies where healers have been sent intention to people who didn't know they were getting healed, and it worked. It's better if the person knows better they believe it. And, you know, there's probably a good argument for saying it's more ethical to do this with somebody who knows they're getting sent intention. But it can, for all those reasons, it can work. It's very, very powerful. And if you believe that, that can go a long way toward making it happen.
Absolutely. Next up, we go to Maggie in Tempe, Arizona, west of the Rockies. Maggie, go ahead.
Hi. The synchronicity, you just talked about what I was going to ask about in terms of, we talked last year about protection, and I wanted to kind of follow up because you had said being in alignment with your purpose does really help with protection. And I have to say I've been doing that. I affirm that I am in alignment with my purpose. And I feel like one of the effects that it's had on me is that I am happier. And I just wondered if, can you design an experiment around that, or is it just too vague?
Designing an experiment about whether or not people in aligning with their purpose would feel happier?
Yeah, you know, in terms of a group intention.
Okay. I mean, it might be hard for us to design a scientific laboratory experiment because we're changing lots of different things. You know, we're asking a lot of individuals with individual life purposes to, you know, to hold on to their life purpose and see if they're happier. But what we could do is do a poll with our readers and our, you know, and our viewers and just see what happens to you and track it to see if that does make you happier. I mean, one thing I talk about a lot of times is aligning yourself in all of your life with your life's intention. You know, understanding that everything you do, every thought you have, that all ultimately becomes your life's intention. So you might have that power thought in the morning, you know, the big thing that you ask for. And then you might have lots of other things that counteract that. Let's say your life's thought is to, or your big thought is that you want to do something to help people in your life. And that's really important to you. But your job is something that, you know, that harms children in some way. It gives them sugary drinks or does something like that that's negative or pollutes the environment. It's not being in alignment. Those two things aren't in alignment. So a lot of things I talk about are making everything in your life in alignment. And that would include being in aligned with your life's purpose, with the thing that puts you in touch with the divine, trying to design your life and move toward that place where everything's in accord and alignment. And then not only are you a real vessel for intention, but you all also are, as you say, you know, you can irresistibly happy.
What do you mean in your work, power it up? What is that?
And that is that whole idea of getting into a really intense mental focus. And I called the Power Up is also the whole program I devised that was really distilling all of the different techniques used by these various intention masters. I tried to take all the common threads from all the different techniques and to put them together into one program. So besides this very focused mind thought, and also this very focused, heart-centered way of sending out intention, I have other things in there. One of the other things is a really important thing is aligning it with a certain time. That we're very, very affected by solar activity. You know, we always think that we're the top dog, the masters of the universe, and that we're the most powerful, energetic element in the universe, in the planets. But nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, there's a lot of scientific evidence to show that we're hugely affected by solar flares, coronal mass ejections, all of the stuff, the gaseous stuff the sun throws out every so often. It hits the Earth's geomagnetic shield, and that has a profound effect on the two major engines of the human body, the heart and the brain. We also know that slightly unsettled solar activity, that means a lot of it, helps mind over matter activity, helps intention, helps, you know, what they call psychokinesis. So I suggest when you know that there's some solar activity going on, that's a better time to send intention. So there's many things like this. All of these various techniques are part of the Powering Up program, the right time, the right place. There is such a right place, too, choosing an intention space. Doing it over and over in that same space. There's good scientific studies to show that healing, for instance, works faster and better when done in the same place.
All right, very good. Next up, Joplin, Missouri. It's got to be Dan the Blind Man.
Hey, George.
Hi, Dan.
Hey, buddy. First of all, I promise I'm not going to take very long, but something absolutely amazing is a milestone tonight.
What is that?
I tested my intention. I called, I got through, I purposely disconnected, called back, and I got through 6 times in a row.
How about that? And by the way, you call yourself Dan the Blind Man. I'm not, right?
Yes.
You got it. Okay, go ahead.
Now, here's the thing I was really calling about, because I didn't realize that one thing was going to happen. Many years ago, when I was in the recording studio, and my dear friend, he's passed on, but he was my studio man, and I went in to do my work, and he had 3 dogs that insisted on being in the studio, but they never made any noise, and normally they did, and they would want to respond because they absolutely insisted on being there as I did my tracks, and they would look up at Chris, and he would always give them the hand signal to be quiet. And they never ruined a single track in all 5 CDs that they were there.
Wonderful.
And I repaired my Braille writer today through psychokinesis.
It works, Dan.
Oh, it does. And what was so weird was I had my hands full, and it had never happened this way before. I had my hands full. The Braille writer was sliding off my lap. And I go, oh, I'm sorry, Braille writer. Please don't get hurt. Because I needed to tighten a whole bunch of stuff up on it, and I was not looking forward to do the work. Well, when it went bam on the floor, I picked it up, and everything was tightened up as if I'd taken it all apart.
I love it. Thanks, Dan.
Dan, it's really interesting. There's a lot of studies showing that we don't just affect living things. We affect machinery, too, for better or worse. You're what they call an angel when it comes to technology, obviously, and I'm a gremlin. When I'm in a bad mood, I break every computer in sight.
Retro intention, going back into time, basically, to change an influence. How does that happen?
Well, there was a really interesting study from a guy who was a real skeptic. He wanted to debunk alternative medicine. So he wanted to devise the most ridiculous study he could think of. So he got a group of patients together who were seriously ill with blood infection, divided the group in half, and prayed for half of them. This is an Israeli professor. Now, after he did that, he then looked at who was, got better, and he found, probably to his dismay, that all the people who had been prayed for did better in every regard. They got out of the hospital quicker, they had less side effects, the whole thing. But there was a real interesting element to the study, a real kicker. The people had been in the hospital in the year 1992 to 94. The study was done in the year 2000. The praying was done in the year 2000, 6 to 8 years later. He sent prayer back in time, then looked at the people who had, by then they were out of the hospital, and he found, lo and behold, the people who had been prayed for did better in every regard. Now, that seems like a really weird one-off, but there have been many, many studies of so-called retro intention, sending intention so-called back in time. Now, it works fine if you think of time just the way you think of space, as one big smeared out now. And I think what the quantum physics shows us now, what modern studies and science show us, is that time isn't this tidy little linear thing that we think of, just, a one-way arrow from cradle to grave, but that things can exist and coexist simultaneously. And so we have to really enlarge our view of time and realize that we could affect things like this. Now, does this mean we can go back and change the past? I don't know that. What it may mean, though, is that we can travel back to things that maybe haven't completely concretized yet, you know, things that haven't completely come to pass yet, but are just in the process of coming to pass and maybe alter that direction. But it's certainly something we need to look at more and more studies are demonstrating it's true. It happens. And also, what we're thinking, a lot of the studies demonstrate that, these were studies Dean Radin did. That was the Psy researcher Dean Radin. He found that in many cases, the future was influencing the present. So it's not necessarily that we're going back and changing the past. It's that the future is changing the present as it unfolds.
When you were doing your work for the field, did you come across anything that just startled you, amazed you?
Oh, George, the whole thing.
The whole thing, didn't it?
I mean, I just was a stunned.
Were you a believer in the field before you got into it?
No, I didn't even know anything about the field. I thought I was going to go. I thought there was something like human energy fields. I mean, I was certainly open to and very sympathetic with alternative medicine, at least alternative medicine that had been demonstrated to work, you know, proved. But I didn't know much about all of this frontier science. I certainly didn't know much about quantum physics. I had to study it in order to understand this. I had to be very patiently tutored in it by all these scientists. And what stunned me, the more I got into it, the more I realized I'd entered a world, you know, I'd taken the pill, the Matrix pill. I couldn't go back.
You were in the Twilight Zone.
Yeah. I was, and I just realized, you know, this completely changed the whole ball game.
When we come back, we're going to take more calls with you, Lynn, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. More phone calls with Lynn McTaggart, The Field. Lynn, the book's still out there, isn't it? Still available?
Oh, it's still selling really well, sure. Yeah.
I got to tell you, I can't tell you how many guests come on this program and quote the book, quote your work.
Well, thank you, and it's really gratifying to just see the response of that and the intention experiment. People just seem to want the scientific proof. I think, you know, even though we all believe, we all have this intuitive feeling that we understand all of this, you know, our Western minds want to have some proof, and that's why I do the work I do. I try to provide a lay public with, you know, the scientific proof, but to try to do it and decode the science so that everybody can understand it.
Let's go back to the phones. We'll go to Annie in Seattle, Washington. Annie, you're on with Lynn.
Yeah, hi, George. Lynn,
hey.
How you doing?
Hey.
Hey, I've got an idea.
All right.
I say, hey, George, you had a great idea last night. I think we should try it again tonight with Linda's help, maybe. I say we try putting out that Mount Wilson Observatory fire tonight in, say, maybe 10 minutes, and we all concentrate on the same thing, the power of intention, and get this thing taken care of. I mean, who would want to burn up an observatory anyway?
Without any lightning around. Well, I guess we need to qualify some of this.
Yeah, yes. No lightning, no cause for anything, but just have it rain and soak it.
Should we do it again, Lynn?
Well, I think that's a really interesting idea. I think what you need to be is really specific, George, just as you said. Both of you, it's a great idea. But we found that the more specific, the better. So as you say, specify the kind of rain you want, how much you want, and the fact that you don't want lightning and thunder, and where, exactly where you want it to come to. And I think that would, you know, why not?
You know, it started raining this morning. Some person emailed me, and she said that she had puddles on her front. The director of the Mount Wilson Observatory said it was raining, that maybe they'd get thunderstorms. There was no rain in the forecast before we did this, Lynn. I mean, it is really – so here's the question. What's the force? What is it that does this?
What is it that's doing this?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think it is don't separate consciousness from the field in a sense. You know, we're just tapping into something that's already there and organizing it. You know, most of the time we go around and we don't really organize consciousness. We don't also tell the universe what we want. We just react to the universe. You know, we don't give it any instructions. What I think is happening is, you're putting out an instruction, a very specific instruction to the universe in consciousness, and consciousness is responding.
Next up, let's go to first-time caller Scott in Venice, California. You're up with us. Hi, Scott.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Well, fantastic. I was listening to your show last Monday night, and it was also an intent-inspired show. And it really got me enthused to continue this art piece. And I was finishing the drawing. I went to Kinko's, and I had to get the drawing scanned. And so I was asking the only one of three people around me in the local area, maybe within a quarter mile, and I was vibrating to her to try to hurry and find out how much it cost to get it scanned. It was taking her about 10 minutes. And so I don't know if I heard it or not, but when I went outside, I must have vibrated the local police to come and get my car ticket at 2:20 in the morning, which I thought was very odd. And then as soon as I noticed the ticket, I looked to my right, and there were these two people just about to collide. And it was as if it was Hollywood. I intended it not to collide, and they were coming so close that I don't think if I intended them not to hit, they would have hit for sure. And so it seemed that trying to hurry the person up that was working at Kinko's actually vibrated the other two people
yeah.
in the local vicinity into doing the same thing, and it kind of...
It backfired.
Totally backfired, yeah, but I was able to pull it off in the very end.
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, I think what's really fun is to try some of this in your life, not only when you've got an emergency situation like that, but just in situations in your life where, you know, something doesn't ever happen. You know, I always tell women, and this is always a good one, I always tell women, you know, if your husband never brings you flowers, send an intention to have him send you, bring you some, because you'll know that's something that ordinarily doesn't ever happen, and that gives you proof of it. Or if you're a guy and your partner hates football and you love football, watching football, send an intention for her to sit down and watch you, or whomever to sit down next to you and watch, and see if that happens, you'll know it works. And, you know, I've asked people to do this, and there's remarkable stories. I had one woman say to me, my husband never brings me flowers. And I was thinking about just that, what you said, when I was waiting in line at a garden center. And he was with me, and I was saying to myself, he never brings me flowers, and look at these gorgeous geraniums. And all of a sudden, he bolted out of the line, brought back this giant plant of gardenias, and said, I had to get this for you. Wow. It was like I got an order in my head. And so I always think of that as, you know, there's proof positive. If you can do something that never happens in your life, do that, and then you know it works.
Yeah, you know, I think this happens all the time, and we just don't notice it. And while listening to your show, you know, we're so enthused about what you're saying, and especially last Monday night as well, that we're convinced that we can actually do it. And sure enough, without really trying too hard, in the rest of your life, you do start to notice that you can do that. But if you try too hard, look what happened to me last Monday night.
Exactly.
Absolutely. We had
you
Stephen
have to
Schwartz
do it and let it go.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for your advice. This is very motivating for people, and I think this is exactly the right kind of topic to really help people out.
Well, we're trying to do that, help people out, too, with, you know, we had started this intention of the week on our site in 2007 because I had a Vietnam vet contact me named Don Barry, and he said, I've got ankylosing spondylitis in my spine. I can't move. I'm a perfect intention experiment because I've got so much scientific data and so many medical studies that if anything changes as a result of intention, we'll be able to document.
Right, and it's dramatic all by itself.
Yeah, and so I said to the readers out there, all my web people said, okay, send an intention to Don. You start doing it. And on their own back, they started sending him intention twice a week. And it was amazing. He wrote me and said he would have been in constant pain. He said, after a few months, you know, my pain's much better. And a few months after that, he wrote again to say, you know, my pain's all gone. So we started putting this on the site and encouraging people. Had another guy called Dan who was in a gas explosion, and he had his little group. He had a website discussion group on my site talking about intention, and his wife wrote to them and said his hands were so burned he was supposed to have skin grafts. And so the wife asked the group to send intention to him. They did. He got out of the hospital in 6 days, didn't need the skin grafts, and his doctors thought he was a medical miracle.
Remarkable.
And so we see this over and over again. And so we've started, as I say, started to do this financial intention of the week. When somebody wrote me and said, you know, my finances are up the spout right now. Anything you guys can do? And so we started doing that too, just to, you know, to demonstrate to people the power of the group, that there are people out there care about you and they can help you.
All right, let's go to Phoenix. Linda, thank you for holding, and it's your turn.
Thank you.
Sure.
George and Lynn, you know what you were saying earlier about focusing intent by way of some healers into an electronic device and then sort of like a battery and then taking it to another location, and that the procedure or purpose for which the intent was stored up, so to speak, was accomplished, like accelerating the fruit fly development.
Mm-hmm.
That's called charging in a lot of different metaphysical traditions. It's been around a very long time. And, for instance, a healing candle or a crystal would be focused on and anointed with a healing oil for a specific healing purpose and then given to the person or burned by the person to accomplish the purpose, sort of like a time relief. And it's the same way that crystals and amulets and talismans are charged with specific intent and purpose. And then they're worn or kept close to the environment, so they release the energetic intent over a period of time for the person. And a good friend of mine has always said, and I found it to be true, that energy follows intent.
And that's a nice phrase.
It's really true. Where you put your intent, it's sort of like pointing an arrow. Where you point the arrow, generally speaking, it's going to hit.
Yes.
You know, you point the arrow, you release the string and let it fly. And generally, it's going to go to its mark unless you're horrifically off target.
Well, that's the interesting thing. I mean, the problem is that's so interesting what you say about charging. It's like, you know, science is just catching up with what spiritual masters have known for centuries. But the arrow that you talk about is so interesting, too, because most of us, you know, I always ask people, you know, how many of you are thinking positive thoughts? You know, most of us are sending our arrows in all the wrong directions, and we're sending out negative arrows with every thought we have.
Right, or if we point the arrow in the generally correct direction, we never quite release it, so it never has the chance to hit the target and then allow it to come back to us that for which it was sent. Or we release the arrow, but we have a string tied to it, and we're following along trying to direct it to make it hit the target.
That's a really good metaphor.
And also, I was going to suggest that regarding intention of rain for the observatory in California, you probably might want to specify a gentle, steady rain that will not cause landslides or mudslides due to the deforested mountainsides now from the fires.
I think that's such a good idea, is to just be very specific about exactly what you want. We're trying to do that. You know, we have our clean water experiment we're running on September 19th that certainly everybody can be involved with. And we've learned through a lot of the other experiments to be very, very specific about what we're trying to do. And in fact, we're even showing a photo and saying, imagine this and change it to this. So that we're, you know, giving people a very, very specific shift to make. Because, as you say, you know, you could create, and I remember, I think it was Art Bell who told me some years back, you were doing, or maybe it was you, George, you said you'd send an intention for rain and you got this enormous, enormous effect.
We did, so much so that we caused landslides.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking of when you were talking about the observatory.
Yeah.
You know, the forests and trees, they're gone from the fires, and you don't have real stable land there now because those anchor the ground. And if you get a lot of heavy-duty rain to put out the fires, you may get that, but you may also wash away and cause mudslides or landslides.
Yes. Well, every intention master that I spoke to really talked about being very, very highly specific.
Absolutely. Let's go to Hawaii, west of the Rockies. Hey, Jenny, take it away, Jenny. Hi there.
Aloha.
Aloha.
George. Oh, wow. I've listened to you for years. I'm so glad to be on the air.
You're
and
welcome.
Lynn,
hi.
I think what you're doing is fantastic.
What island are you on, by the way, Ginny?
I am on Oahu.
Ah,
and
beautiful.
I've got a story for you. I emailed you a picture once, a photo. You have a photo from me that you put online, but of a sun dog. But I've been wanting to come on for a long time to tell you. One, I healed cancer. I understand the whole thing about intention. I teach a form of medical Qigong that's number one in China now that is 95% effective for healing because it uses intention. It's 95% effective. And I've been teaching for 10 years, and I have so many stories of people with paralysis, with stage 4 cancer, who have turned it around, and not months and years, but in weeks, in a few months. And a woman who, and the man who called who was you mentioned that was paralyzed. I have, there's a famous artist in Hawaii called Peggy Chun who just passed recently. But she was doing this method and she was using the intention. And like you say, Lynn, the specific, it's got to be specific visualization plus desire. And I've found out that healing cancer is no different than reaching for a glass of water because the principle is the same. The principle of the field, the principle of energy is the same because it where the thought goes, the energy flows. That's
absolutely
how I picked up this phone. And it's no different than that. And the level of healing comes when the person has the desire behind it. If you want to go get ice cream, and you're kind of lukewarm about it, you'll get red lights on the way. You'll get there. Your kind of ice cream won't be there. You know, you can test this out. If you really, really want it, you know, all of a sudden in the middle of traffic, you'll have green lights, and you'll get the same ice cream on sale with both kinds that you like. And the same with healing. I've seen it over and again. I've taught over 3,000 students here in Hawaii over the past 10 years.
That's great.
And I'm healed totally from stage 3 advanced cancer. My story is written up in Chicken Soup for the Soul. And I'm finishing a book called Cancer Gone. But there's, or my $100,000 haircut.
Got all that. So well, that's fantastic. So I mean, I've been really impressed by work demonstrating that cancer can be another form of a toxic thought.
Exactly. You're right on.
There's a German doctor called Reichard Hammer who he found this after his son got killed. He developed testicular cancer, and he thought to himself, wow, that's kind of ironic, isn't it? Because that's where the child was from, basically. So he wondered whether or not cancer is a trauma and whether or not it has, you know, certain kinds of cancers that produce certain kinds of physical effects. Mm-hmm. And he found that. It did. So what he does is he doesn't treat the cancer tumor. He treats the trauma,
yes,
the psychological trauma, and the cancer goes away.
Exactly. That's what we do with this Qigong. It releases it shamanically. It has to be a nonverbal level. It can't be intellectual. That's how my healing came to me overnight. My blood counts went from zero to normal overnight.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Wow.
And
that is brilliant.
And this one woman who was paralyzed from the neck down, she's famous in Hawaii as an artist. I said, you're an artist, Peggy. I mean, you have 20, you know, you're 56. You've been paralyzed 2 years. You have 54 years of body-mind message that you can move. Only 2 years of paralysis. And I said, all you need to do is watch the video and visualize. So she did. All the whole hour and a half. I said, just do 16 minutes. I came home to her at the end of the week, and I said, you got something to show me? And she says, yeah, look at this. And she's wiggling her big toe. And then the next week, she was swinging her leg from her knee.
That's right. Hey, Ginny, did you ever meet Brada Iz when he was alive?
I never did, and I've only been here 10 years.
Ah, that would have been a treat.
What beautiful music.
Yeah, absolutely.
Talk about.
All right, thanks, Ginny.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lynn, what do you do next? Experiments continue, don't they?
Experiments continue. As I say, we're doing clean water experiment, and we're running that September 19th for everybody who wants to be involved. What we're going to be doing after that, we're going to be doing the bacteria one, then we're going to be doing the one on pH, but then I want to move on to creating a gaiosphere. I want to see if we can lower temperature with our thoughts, but to do this scientifically, we've got to create an artificial environment. So I want to create a little kind of like a mini world, like a little terrarium, and put a little primitive animals and plants in, and see if we can lower the temperature or the CO2 levels. If we can do it there, then we can start trying it in a big way. But also next year, I'm going to be coming out to the field a bit. I'm going to a special conference on water with Masaru Emoto in Japan, and we're going to be trying to lower pollution in a very polluted lake near Kyoto. I'm also going to be going to Jerusalem, and there I'd like to do some sort of peace intention
experiment.
That
would be dramatic if you could pull that off.
Exactly. Well, now it's time to start moving out and bringing this work out into real life. So I want to be I want to try to, you know, clean up pollution, lower violence in a variety of places, and really not only demonstrate that it can work in the laboratory, but that it can work in real life.
Lynn, we're going to take a final hour of phone calls with you when we come right back. Again, the book is called The Field, The Quest for the Secret Force of the Universe, with our special guest tonight, Lynn McTaggart. And her websites are linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. So we'll be back with a final hour of phone calls with Lynn on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Lynn McTaggart, and the rest of your phone calls as well. Lynn, are you doing this all by yourself with research these days?
Well, I'm always working with a team of scientists. So I'll work with Gary Schwartz, or I've worked with Konstantin Korotkov, Russian physicist at St. Petersburg Technical University, or Rustam Roy at Penn State University, Jessica Utz, as I mentioned, at University of California. So I'm always working with their team. But I've worked, and sometimes I'm connecting with people like the Unity people or the Association for Global New Thought. They worked with me a bit on the peace intention experiment, just joining forces to let their groups know about it.
Okay, back to the phones we go. Champaign, Illinois, east of the Rockies. Hey, Lynn, go ahead.
Hi, yes, this is Lynn from Champaign. I've been listening to your show since 2004, George. You're doing a fabulous job.
Enjoy, thanks.
This is wonderful, and I'm definitely going to Lynn's website. I have a story. I have been healed from 5 near-death experiences.
Wow.
Completely healed, yes. And I believe it's because of persistence and aligning myself with God's will. I've been what I perceive to be God's will. I brought myself to my knees many times, and for each of these, I asked God, I absolutely said, God, you have to heal me. It wasn't like I was commanding God, but I was told that what was happening was as I implored to the angels, and I didn't even know about the angels when I did that, but that is what was happening. Of course, I don't tell God what to do. But aside from that, what happened was that I healed. Nothing else had worked. I've healed. I'm part of a 12-step fellowship that deals with bulimia, and I've had bulimia since I was 15. And through this program, I've kept off 60 pounds for almost 9 years. I don't actively do any of the bulimic activities. And I'm a positive person by nature, but these things that I was afflicted with, which I can mention, one of them was a coma I was in when I was 19. I had a 50-50 chance of living. I survived that with no damage, and I'm 53.
Wow.
Another thing was that I've had 2 cancers, which I've healed completely from. I have a 98% chance of them never having again. 2 breast cancers, and I got to keep both, all of my body. And the doctors have told me that, well, I'm four years out from one and 9 years out from the other, so I've got a 98% chance of never having it happen again. And the thing that I just wanted to mention that was really important to me was that I don't pray for myself other than healing. And in the 12-step fellowships, what we do is it's a group of people that, as you know, maybe are aware of, pray for others. And the whole purpose behind prayer is not to ask for yourself, unless I believe healing is a prayer that you can ask for. And obviously, it seems to have helped me. I've been doing what I appear is God's will, what appears to me is God's will, and that's alignment. So when I was in my coma, my family and friends were all around praying for me, and I believe that that helped. And my brain disorder is healed. And I'm a writer. I'm a student. I've been published. And I believe that the alignment part of my story is that God's will for me is to help other bulimics through my example, to be a good friend and daughter, to be a good seamstress because I sew, and to be a good writer and student. And I can do all of those, but only if I am sincerely trying to practice God's will, and that's alignment. That's the first part of alignment. And the first 2 years of my recovery from bulimia, all I did at night when I went to sleep is pray to God to heal me. That's all I asked for 2 years, every single night. Said my prayers, thank God for what he's given me during the day, and prayed for my bulimia to be healed. And that's what I do. I just simply pray for that. I don't ask for prayers for anything, for money, nothing for myself.
And you don't push it. You just send it out there, don't you?
And exactly. And trust is so important. And even, I have found that even if you can't trust, if you find you don't have the trust, if you have the willingness to put into practice the discipline of prayer in the form of, you know, you can fake it. You know, you can have a discipline and fake the trust. And if you just have the willingness, all it takes is a teeny bit. Then God opens the door, and you do begin to have trust and faith, because that's what starts the ball rolling. You don't have to believe it at first. You just a crack in the door of willingness, and the practice of praying for God's will eventually open that door wider, and you will begin to see things happen, and your trust evolves. Like I said, I'm naturally a positive person, even though these were desperate times, and I was desperate many times on my knees. But my positive nature, which, you know, I guess I'm lucky with that, that has kept me persistent. I've been in recovery for 22 years from bulimia. And I tell you, it's the most amazing thing. I mean, it's wonderful. What God
you've just said, everything you've said has been so good, because you said so many great things. And one was that was really important was the whole thing of it doesn't have to be trust at the beginning, just that willingness. Just the willingness to keep doing it and to just say, okay, I'm just going to keep praying. And, you know, we talk about prayer, you know, prayer and intention, because you were so specific about what you wanted, it's in a sense equivalent. A lot of people do prayer and they just say, you know, thy will be done. Whatever you want from me, I'll accept. But I guess where we're making the distinction with intention is that it's, you know, you're making a very specific request. But the other really important thing you said was you pray for other people. You know, one of the things that I've tried to distinguish in my own work is to say intention isn't just about getting more stuff.
No,
it's about healing. Mm-hmm. And it's about healing others. And what we've found, and this is, you know, really stumbling onto this because my own groups of people and on the website and in workshops and when I meet people and speak to them, I've just by accident, in a sense, put people in small groups and have them do intention for each other, healing intention. And the remarkable things have happened. Not only have the healies, the people chosen to be the target, got better, and all sorts of amazing things have happened with back pain, migraines, gut problems, eye problems, pains people have lived with, arthritis, etc., but also the healers themselves report feeling better. The people sending the intention, their healing challenges have got better. And it's like healing heals the healer.
Right.
So part of what I think that's really important about his intention is this virtuous circle of creating a group, a small group, where it, or a large group, as with, you know, as we're trying to do, but that And also the people involved with our intention experiments report. I take surveys afterwards saying, how did your life change? And the peace intention experiment in particular, but also the clean water experiment, people in the peace intention experiment said, my life became much more peaceful after this, particularly with strangers. You know, yes, they got along better with their loved ones, but the most remarkable change was how they felt and reacted and interacted with strangers. Healing, sending out healing for the world, healed them.
Lynn, is this force God?
You know, let's try to define God first.
Oh, that won't be easy.
You know,
let me rephrase the question.
Let me rephrase it.
Could this force be what some people have called God?
Yes. I mean, because, you know, people always say, oh, well, the field, it must be anti-religion. And I say, no, it's providing, approving of religion. You know, you can call the field God or the Holy Ghost or whatever. You know, as long as you think of God as not something other than you. you know, not the man that sits on the cloud above and other and judging you. If God is all embracing and all part of you, whichever name you want to call him, that's really what we're talking about here. You know, we're talking about the all that is, the source.
Yes, absolutely. Los Angeles we go. Mark? Hey, Mark, take it away.
Okay, tonight's show is off the hook. It's hitting me in more ways than one. Question.
Sure.
Can one send intent into the future in order to help us in the present?
Great question.
That's a really interesting question.
I love
Thanks
that.
So much for that. I think you can, because the evidence about retro intention, as I mentioned earlier, is demonstrating that it's not like we go back and fix the past, but that something from the future is coming back and affecting the present as it's unfolding. That seems to be the evidence we have to date, and that the choices in the future affect the choices in the present. There was a really interesting psychological experiment that Dean Radin did demonstrating just that. It was just choices of keys, and he found that future choices affected present ones. So the future was affecting the present at every moment. So why not try it? Pick something that you don't think is going to happen at all. This is what I say always with an intention, personal intention experiment. Pick something you think is really unlikely. So if it happens, you'll know it was the result of your intention. And try to do that. Send an intention for the future and then see what happens to your present.
Okay, we go next to, and thanks again, Mark, for that question. Let's go to Ocean City, New Jersey. Chris, it's your turn. Hi, Chris.
Hi, George. Hi, Lynn. Fantastic
hey.
Show tonight. It's unbelievable.
She's right on tonight.
It just hit home so much with me that I had to share my story with you. And it's so specific that even when I tell it, I don't believe most of it. But anyway, after a failed marriage, I fell into a bout of depression and drug addiction and alcohol addiction for like 2 years. And I was just so unhappy. And I finally just near the end of what I call my addiction, like after 2 years of it, I was just so fed up and I was just so low that, you know, I was never into organized religion or anything, but I started praying to my higher power to either cure me or kill me. And I didn't mean it literally. I was saying either help me help myself to be better or give my life force to somebody who really wants to live, and you know, and I was being unselfish in that way. Well, anyway, after about a week of praying this, I started getting questions in my head, like, what would make you happy? What, you know, and I started thinking, well, I really would like a soulmate. I would like my soulmate. But then I started getting more specific and, like, you know, thinking of qualities that I wanted in a partner and, you know, in a wife or whatever. And I started thinking, you know, I would like a nurse because then she could understand this addiction thing and everything like that. And I started thinking other smaller things, really into music because I'm a musician. And then after a while, it just, a name even surfaced, the name Kim. And, I mean, I had no relationship with anyone named Kim in my life up to that point. Well, here's the unbelievable part. 6 weeks later, I met at my work. She didn't work with me, but she was in where I worked. I met a nurse named Kim, and I have been here now for 5.5 years, and we have been together, and she is my absolute soulmate.
Changed your life, didn't it?
Oh my Lord, it is unbelievable. And I mean, it is so specific that I know people will be listening to this going, well, I am telling you that is so 100% true. And it is just, and when you guys were talking about that tonight, it just rang such a bell. I had to share the story with you. And I mean, it is so unbelievable. It changed my life. And I mean, you know, I continue to think positive and, like you said, to pray for others, you know, family members and other things that are going on. But that story is just unbelievable and with me, and I get goosebumps every time I tell it.
That is so wonderful. I love that. You know, it happened to me too, George, too. I got divorced, and I was sitting there saying, I don't want that to happen again. So who's the perfect person for me? And I thought, you know what? I'm so strange, I need somebody just like me. So I thought, I need somebody who even has the same astrological chart as me. That's how specific I got. And I said, I want him to be a writer, I want him to be this and that, so that he's a lot like me, so I'm not strange to him. And literally weeks later, just like we just heard, Brian came into my life, who is another journalist, a writer, and has pretty much an identical star chart.
That's great. That's great. I mean, that's how you click.
That exactly, absolutely. So it's, I think that whole idea of trying to be very specific, even about your partner, really works. I hear it time and time again.
Absolutely. It does work. No doubt about that. You're living proof. Salt Lake City, Utah. Molly, west of the Rockies. Hi, Molly.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I was wondering if it could go as far as the micro level, say, in the swine flu. If everybody, well, in the world would be nice, but, you know, you get groups of people together to render it innocuous or harmless.
Molly, this is a really interesting question, because I can put on my other hat, you know, for this, and answer it out of both sides. I do a newsletter called What Doctors Don't Tell You, and we look at what works and what doesn't work in conventional and alternative medicine, and that's what got me on this whole journey. And we've looked at the swine flu in great detail. We've done a big report on it, by the way. And we've looked at how dangerous this really is compared to ordinary flu. And I think what's happened with swine flu is it's fear that's caught hold, not any real evidence of giant danger. And so I think, you know, we talked about earlier in the show a negative fear that takes hold like a virus. And I think that's what's going on here. So what I've asked people to do, and we did an intention of the week about this, was to take the fear out of swine flu now. And the fear that's gripping everybody. So the fear is oftentimes what causes an epidemic or causes it, you know, and it creates the worry and creates the susceptibility, not the virus itself. It's not really that dangerous a virus. And it's just us being so terrified of it. So I would like to see some collective intentions about this. And I'd happily, you know, I'd happily spearhead it.
Well, that's the way to do it. Next up, we go to San Pedro, California, first-time caller. Hey, Rio, go ahead.
Hi. My question was about holy water. Do you believe that a priest blessing water to make it holy water actually has an effect on it, or what kind of effect that would have?
Or is it intent? What is it?
What a great question. I mean, if you look at it from the non-religious point of view, sending blessing into a water is definitely an intention. As I say, I've worked with Melinda Connor, who does experiments like this with water, and we've done them in our own workshops where we embed a word in the water, and then we ask the audience to figure out what's the word embedded in the water, and a huge percentage know it. There's something in water that carries an imprint of information. Water is got something, a very specific quality to it that physicists call coherent domains. It's like, basically that means it's like a tape recorder. And so it's not too far-fetched to think a priest is actually embedding water with a blessing. It carries it.
Okay, next up. Well, no, next up, we're going to take this break. Wow, that was fast, Lynn.
It sure was.
All right, we'll come back. We'll take final phone calls with you. Lynn McTaggart, author of The Field, and also The Intention Experiment. We'll be back. Okay, we've got final phone calls with Lynn McTaggart. Lynn, thanks for sticking around this extra hour, by the way.
This has been really fun, George, I must say.
Houston, Texas, we go, east of the Rockies. Hey, Mark, go ahead.
George, thank you very much for having Lynn on tonight.
Thank you.
Lynn, I have some problems in my back. I've got, of course, the discs are collapsing, and now I've got some pressure on nerves that I have two neurosurgeons and a pain management doctor tell me I'm going to have a fusion, which I'm trying to avoid like the plague. I have problems in a knee. I have doctors tell me I need a knee replacement. I hear about these, quote, miracle self-cures. I know that the George has a guest on frequently Christian Wild that who follows stem cell development. I often wonder now, George, if the transformation of the stem cells into the various elements of the body that the body needs is really just an extension of intention.
Yeah, good
but,
point.
But, Lynn, what I wanted to find out from you is how can a lay person begin the process, begin the journey to acquire the skills to learn how to at least make the attempt at self-healing? As I say, I'm trying to avoid the knife and the surgeons as much as I possibly
can. Of course. Well, I think there's several things. First of all, don't feel you have to do it alone. I think that's one of our biggest problems, as I said earlier on the program. We've isolated ourselves so much in our Western society, particularly in places like America and Great Britain, where I live, that we don't really have a sense of community. You know, in the past, communities would get together and try to help somebody like you through various means. So I would suggest some sort of community approach. Now, one way to do it is just to put yourself forward as an intention of the week on our site. All you do is write into our site, just get on my webpage at theintentionexperiment.com, and it explains how to do it. And you'll be put up there, and all the thousands of people around the world who follow my work will set an intention for you one time. Now, in terms of doing it yourself, I have found after studying this that certain techniques work better than others. I tried to put them together in a program I call Powering Up, and that's in detailed in my book, The Intention Experiment. So one suggestion may be just to go through that and practice what I suggest for you to do in the book.
Okay.
And it has the right times, the right places, the right mind state, the right emotional state, how to be specific, how to let go, how to work with all of your senses, a whole bunch of stuff like that. So that's part of it. Now, if all of those things aren't working too, I would create a small intention group in your community. You can also do it on our website. Lots of people do it too, like that, and have them send continual intention to you.
Okay, well, it sounds like the first step is to get your book, which should be a pretty simple step.
Thanks. Sorry for the plug.
No, I mean, it makes sense. Guys, thank you very, very much.
Okay, Mark, thank you,
too. Thank you, Mark.
Next up, let's go to Gainesville, Florida. Ray, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi, Ray.
Hey, George and Lynn. Listen, I have some vital statistics for sending intentions and prayers to the Griffith Park Observatory. Well, first off, when I was five or 6 years old, I walked 5 miles up to the Griffith Park Observatory, so I know something about it. Also, my sister met her husband. She is a rocket scientist, and she met her husband, who is also a rocket scientist, while they were making telescope mirrors in the basement, okay? And it's not just telescopes in the Griffith Park Observatory. There's all kinds of sensitive experiments and exhibits going on inside. It's a museum. It's a scientific museum for young people and everyone. So there's a lot of sensitive equipment inside that, even though it has the cement walls on the outside. Okay, it is a narrow plateau that has asphalt parking lots and one road in that is also asphalt. So you're looking at a very precarious situation at 40 or 60-foot wall banks, 40 or 60-foot hills on three sides that lead up to the observatory. And so it's very, and then if all the vegetation goes away, then you have rain that would wash out, as well as the danger of the fires damaging the sensitive equipment inside the place. So that's why I'm sending this intention that and prayers that that's a very vulnerable and a very needful place for Los Angeles County.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that you could do is incorporate in your intention that area is spared in particular, and that, or the water reaches there first, or something like that, where you just, you know, we've made it with a lot of our intentions experiments that are the scientific ones. We've been very specific. We've said we want these plants to grow 4 millimeters by the, or 4 centimeters by the third day of growing, that kind of stuff. So we put out a real specific request. It's like ordering something from a restaurant. You put out a really specific request.
Next up, we go to Tracy, California, west of the Rockies. Glenn, it's your turn.
Hi, George.
Hey.
I recently went through a battle of lymphoma cancer, and my doctor encouraged me to, you know, seek out other options, you know. What I'm worried about is that people will rely on this, you know, and not the medical breakthroughs and the medical. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind, if it wasn't for the skill of my doctor and the medical breakthroughs, that I wouldn't be here today. But my doctor also encouraged me to, you know, to look, go through the spiritual, on my spiritual side and other options. I juiced, you know, I did everything that I could. And you know, a good doctor would tell you that your frame of mind is a big part of your battle.
I think your doctor gets 100 points for what he suggested. And the fact that he's so open-minded is really unusual in medicine, that he was saying, let's combine the best of both. I've come to believe, because you remember I study medicine, too. That's my other hat. I wear it, What Doctors Don't Tell You. And I used to tell people, oh, do this kind of thing because it's got a lot of evidence, or don't do that kind of thing, or don't follow this kind of medicine, or don't follow this. And, you know, the more I work with this whole thing of intention, the more I think that the only thing that's important is the power of somebody's belief. You know, whatever medicine you think is going to work for you is the one that's going to work for you. And that comes from seeing a lot of studies, placebo effects, where people were given even not just pills, they were given in one case an operation in Houston, and the arthritis patients who had just got the sham operation believed they'd had the real thing, and they were pain-free afterward. So what I'm saying is, I'm not saying your doctor was operating on a placebo effect. He obviously had a lot of skill and he did brilliant things, but your belief played a huge part in it too. And I think it plays a huge part in everybody's kind of healing. So that what's probably important in my view is to take whatever medicine it is that you truly believe is going to work. And that's the thing that's probably going to move the mountains for you.
Okay, thank you. Let's go to Cerritos, California, and it's Terry's turn. Hi, Terry.
I love how you Cerritos. You must be. You must live out here.
I do.
I wanted to mention something. You talked about casting things into the future that would control the present, but you also said that you have a. And please don't take this as confrontational, but you also had said you believe that, you know, it has a religious aspect to it and in God and all that. And I've always had this you know, discussions with people. That, you know, if you can go into the future, if you believe that you can actually go into the future, then really, then you're taking away the doctrine of self choice, that the future's already done, it's already written in for you, and therefore, then you really don't have any control over it. So therefore, you know, anything you do, good or bad, is really not your fault. It's not, it's just, you know what I'm saying? It's like a religious aspect. So how do you deal with that? Seemingly dichotomy. Yes.
Okay. Well, first of all, I think that the future not as a script that's already written, but as a potential script. And so we're not really talking about fluid things and tendencies. Like, you know, it's very much like quantum physics. When they talk about an electron, they don't talk about a set entity. They talk about many possibilities of something, and that it settles down into a something when, you know, certain conditions happen. And so I think that's what happens with the future too. You're talking about the present and the future as a myriad of fluid possibilities that just are almost like a ball on a roulette machine, you know, a roulette wheel that will settle into one place. So I look at it that way, and I look at a lot of different possibilities happening in the future that would also, being fluid, also affecting the present fluid. But I also think of time as being ever-present and not the linear thing that we're thinking of. And if you think of it as ever-present, you also get away from the idea of causality and an absolute, you know, absolute definite future that governs your life and what's going to happen.
What do you think Edgar Casey Lynn would have said about this, the power of intent?
I think he would have been totally in tune with it all. I mean, he, you know, was looking so much at ESP in particular, but he was really talking about things beyond the, you know, the empirical. He was talking about things beyond what we see and realizing that and trying to study and understand you know, these intuitive abilities that we have. And so I like to think of ESP as, you know, developing good ESP is developing being a good receiver, being a good television in a sense. You remember I said we're like a television sender, you know, a television station and a television set all at the same time. So being good ESP is becoming a good television set, and being a good intender is being a good television station and broadcasting well.
Is there anything that scared you or bothered you about your work, something that you thought could go awry as you looked at the power
of
all of this?
Yeah, it scares me. It scared me when I was first doing healing intention for people on the website. It scared me when we were first foraying out into the peace intention experiment. You know, what if we blow up the whole country? I'm very careful about not yet doing an intention, a collective intention for all of us, sending an intention for a child, you know, having thousands of people do it.
Overwhelming.
Where we're all doing it at the same moment, because, you know, I don't know yet whether we're going to blow his head off. You know, you said, you know, you were worried in the beginning when you did that ask for request for rain and you got a torrential,
floods.
You know, I think it's something really careful. We're not sure what we've got here yet. We're just learning. So I think this is why I think sometimes the baby steps are important. Having said that, you know, you and I have talked about this a lot, doing an experiment together in the past. And maybe it's time we did try something controlled.
Yep, you control it, and we'll provide the latitude in the forum for it.
Well, let's talk about that further. I think that would be a really great idea.
I'm working on an internet experiment with Paul Smith on remote viewing.
Fantastic. You know, I know Paul.
And I think he could put together a real good one, pretty controlled, and we'll see what happens.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, we can do the same. We'll try doing the same, and it would be really good to do something for peace or for water or something like that where it's really, you know, connected to you.
Super. Next up, we go to San Antonio, Texas, Isabel, east of the Rockies. Good morning,
hi,
Isabel.
Hi, George. Hi, Lynn.
Hi.
And I'm just calling to tell you that the way you're saying that several people can get together, that's so true. I think also Linda, she called and asked, you know, said that also if you focus your mind and you send and direct is more, you know, it's very accurate because I would communicate with the Maya natives, the beings, and that's the way they told me that they built the pyramids. They would all surround, but they said that spiritually, but what they would do is focus on the that stone going up there, you know, direct where they wanted it. You see, and that's why they told me that the reason it's hard for us is because we're more focused on the material world and not the spiritual world.
Yes.
You see,
yes.
And we would, you know, like block ourselves from the material world for a while and then, you know, just meditate because all they would do is just hold their hands and then with their mind that you could see the stone. That's what they told me. That's the way they built the pyramids.
Well, you know, there's so much that we can't account for. You know, all of those native masters of intention who are able to levitate and, you know, lie on nails and change their body temperature by 20 degrees or all those sorts of amazing miracles as we think of them and heal, you know, are just focused and trained power of the mind. And it's just something we've lost, they had, we've lost, and now we have to learn how to use again.
Do you think it's because we get lost in the material world?
Yeah, because, well, and I think fundamentally it's because we've been told a very different story about who we are.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
yeah.
They heard something very different, and that informed how they were going to live their lives. So one of my life's work, I suppose, my divine purpose, I hope, is to tell people a different story and to open them up to some of this.
Okay, thank you.
Do you find the zero-point field to be what I've always called the wireless internet, Lynn?
Absolutely. That's a brilliant name for it, George. That's just what it is, and it's putting us all in touch with everything all at the same moment. And we can get to absolutely out to the furthest reaches of the cosmos through this.
And we don't have to reboot our brains either.
Yes, and there's no crash or hacking in, I don't think.
Let's go to California. John, go ahead, John.
Oh, hi, George.
Hi.
What a great show.
She's super.
Thank you.
What an honor to talk to the both of you. Lynn, I read your book several years ago, and I just devoured it. It was such a fascinating read.
Thank you so much.
I wanted to put out there that there's a lot of us in this country that are really quite worried about what's going on in Washington these days, and are afraid that we could lose our Constitution eventually if all these things come to pass with the bills that are being put out there with all the money that's being spent. Some of the things in these bills, it looks like tyranny to me to force people to sign up for health care or be fined. So I'm wondering if, those of us that, the people that are concerned about this, that are going to the town halls and stuff, if we could all have an intention experiment, I think everybody in this audience would probably like to do that for our country. And mm-hmm. just the best outcome, and I was wondering what you think about that. And then also I had something on...
Okay, we've got just a minute left, so let's just do this one here.
Okay, all I would say is whatever intention that happens together, which is a lovely idea, be something that unites people and not divides them further. That's one of the biggest problems in America now, I think, is a crumbling of community and people not really focused together. So I'd like to see that, but see it focused as a community, as a unifying element.
Well, why don't we do an experiment to either minimize road rage or do something like that and test people? I got to tell you, I've seen more people angry and whacked out than ever mm-hmm. in my life.
I agree. Well, let's talk about it. I think it's wonderful if we could do something where we can really test it. It gives some of your work, some credibility.
Absolutely. Lynn, thanks again for being on the program.
Well, thank you so much. And can I invite everybody, too, to take part in our clean water experiment?
Just give us the website.
Okay. They come on either my website, theintentionexperiment.com, www.theintentionexperiment.com, or directly onto thecleanwaterexperiment.com.
Perfect. Thecleanwaterexperiment.com. And then follow up with us, Lynn. Let us know how it goes. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norris, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.